Need some motivation on your Chinese business endeavour? Maybe curious about what the Chinese business environment is all about? Or want to laugh out loud listening to war stories on the ground in China? Then this is your show, China Business Cast.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to another China Business Cast. We are at number 46 today. How you doing, Shlomo?
I'm good.
Yeah, I
think exhausted.
Yeah, we're both really tired. You had some family get-togethers?
Yeah, we had a family wedding just last night, and I went to sleep really late and then got up early. Can't sleep late with a baby. So it's been hectic, and also the whole of yesterday was, you know, preparing and stuff. So, but I'm recuperating and we'll be fine.
Yeah, and I just got back from Shanghai, a delayed flight, but as expected, seems like there's always a delay. So I got back a little bit late last night, and just been a lot of catching up to do here back in Shenzhen. So it was a WeChat conference. We had a little table and we did some interviews for China Business Cast, which you listeners will get to hear in coming episodes. So excited for
that. We've got them piled up for you.
Yeah, we got lots of great ones. So it's really good insights, and I was learning too. So yeah, I mean, ready for this week's show? How about you, Shlomo? What do you got?
Okay, so this week's show, we've got Niels Peel, and he's a friend from Beijing, and he runs a startup called Train Tracks, and they do big data. And in China, when you're saying big data, it's really big. That was a really, really interesting talk. Niels is also part of a movement called Bay Area, and Bay is B-E-I for Beijing. And you're going to hear all about this at the show, so we can tune in. But before we do that, I got another special announcement. I don't know if you missed this or not, but we have a WeChat group special for China Business Cast. There are two ways that you can join, and would love if you can, if you want to join. One way is going to chinabusinesscast.com, and on this episode's show notes, we'll put the QR code so you scan it and then you just join. This is using WeChat, okay? We're also going to add a WeChat link on the show notes. The other way is that instead of scanning the QR code, if you've got some problem, you can just add me personally to WeChat. Add my username. That's Shlomo F. That's S-H-L-O-M-M-O-F. I repeat, that's S-H-L-O-M-O-F. You can add me, send a message, and then I'll add you to the group. Let's tune in.
Okay, let's tune in.
Okay, hello everybody, and welcome to another China Business Cast. We have Mike here as always. Hey, Mike.
Hey.
And we have Niels Peel. Niels is a good friend from Beijing. We know each other for, I don't know, maybe 4 years, 5 years. I think we met at Barcamp. He's the CEO of a startup called Train Tracks, which is a big data company. He's going to say more about himself soon, but he's coming from the game industry. That's his background. And he's a frequent speaker at conferences. We meet a lot there, actually. And also being quoted many times on gaming magazines and things like that. Niels, great to have you.
Nice to be here. Hello, everyone.
So, Niels, I gave this really short intro, but just so people would know what exactly you do these days and what Train Tracks does, please tell us.
Yeah, so I've been working on Train Tracks for 3 years now, and it's the largest project I have ever undertaken. I used to do behavioral consulting. I used to help companies, especially the game industry, as you mentioned, understand why people do things and how to make them behave differently. And as part of that consultancy, analytics was a very important thing that we were doing. And we learned over the years that there were a couple of just really big holes in the way that people handled big data and handled analytics. And we noticed that at a certain point, almost every software company builds their own analytics tool. There are plenty of like software as a service tools that people will use to get started. But at a certain point, people start building their own in-house tools. And we had the idea that any market that's do-it-yourself is a market that's ripe for disruption. And we wanted to see if we could build something akin to Unity, you know, an engine for building things, but for in-house systems, so that we could help people build better in-house systems faster, and have had as a goal for a long time now to be able to have, you know, same day deployment. You want an in-house system that's customizable to your needs. That shouldn't be a multi-month or multi-year project with someone like Oracle. You should have it today. And that's the holy grail that we've been chasing for 3 years now.
Great. I see.
Very excited. So that, yeah, I mean, I guess it's, you've kind of answered it in that introduction, but you have quite a long history here in China, like all of us here. And so you maybe just dig in a little bit deeper of how you've actually found the idea of train tracks.
I think from a pretty technical point of view, one of the problems with dealing with data is the underlying format of the data. Every data set looks different. And the reports that you build on top of data are not that unlike something like a URL. You know, the report needs to know what it's pointing towards. And that means that if you change something in the underlying data, your reports might break. And that makes it very difficult and fragile to move around in this environment. It also means that you have to front load a lot of your work. You have to know already at the design stage of, like if you're making a game, for example, you need to know already in the design stage what kinds of questions you want to be asking. Because if you don't, the data won't be there. And if you try to add that additional data, you might break a lot of the work that you've already done. So we kept running into difficulties with our consultancy where many times doing the analytics to answer the questions that we needed for our consultancy was way more expensive than our consultancy. And we saw that as a sales blocker for us. And quite honestly, you know, when we started building train tracks, we didn't have the idea that we were going to do a startup. We went to some investor friends of ours and said, we'd like to borrow $20,000 just to build an internal tool so that we can be more profitable with our consulting. And the investors actually convinced us to do it full time.
So you're not going for consultancy anymore?
We are still doing consultancy, but in a different way. We have decided that we're doing less of the behavioral stuff and we're focusing on just building excellent in-house systems. So the way that we operate is when we find someone that's trying to build an in-house system, we try to sell as much of our system as possible. And where it doesn't fit, we go in and we help them build something and we learn from that experience so that we can make a repeatable process for them in the future. So the idea is kind of to help people build in-house systems up until the point that we have exactly what people need so they won't have to do it again.
Mm-hmm. So we had a few feedbacks from listeners asking specifically about the business aspect of starting out and keeping it lean. People were asking about what kind of help small companies, and at this conversation, obviously, train tracks, getting from either VCs or government or these kind of things. What kind of help you had when starting out and what were the efforts you made to keep it lean? Because I also remember that we spoke about this.
Yeah. So we haven't had a lot of interactions with the government yet. We recently applied for some government projects because we finally actually set up our WFI. But for a long time, we actually didn't think that we were going to stay. I think like a lot of software startups, we assume that at a certain level of success, you have to go to Silicon Valley. And we realized after a while that we really shouldn't go. So now we've, you know, really planted our roots here and admitted to ourselves that we're staying. But early on, the kind of help that we got from VCs was really, especially for me, you know, opening my eyes to the world of startups, that, you know, being backed by investors is a thing that you can do. I wasn't entirely aware of that. You know, I came from a more of a traditional small business background where I worked in software, but it was a business, right? There were no investors. It had been bootstrapped. And I kind of assumed that's the way everyone did it. And VCs taught me that there is another business model out there and that you can shoot for bigger problems and move faster, ideally, with the help of these investors. So that was an entire change in context and perspective for me that was very helpful. But we ended up kind of being controversial with the VC community very early on, because after, you know, we got their mentorship, we decided that the best way for us to raise money was on an uncapped convertible note. And back in 2013 in China, that was intensely uncommon. And we kind of had a slight falling out with the local VC community, where people, you know, wanted to bet against us succeeding racing on those terms, because a lot of people feel that uncapped notes are very, very founder friendly. And we were many times told, you know, we wouldn't be able to raise a single dollar. We've raised $600,000 now, so it does work. And it's one of the most important things that we've done to keep our business lean, actually. Because one of the things that we saw were difficult as we were transitioning into building train tracks was that we knew that we didn't know from the get-go what needed to be built, right? We just knew that here's a huge do-it-yourself industry, and it should, in theory, be possible to do something here. But we don't know exactly what we're going to have to build. We're going to have to iterate on this a bit. And we were also very, very early adopters on some new technology, like, for example, Spark. We were one of the first three teams in the world to touch this technology, Spark. And we wanted to be honest about the fact that no one knows where this is going. So we felt no one can reasonably come up with a valuation for us at seed stage, not this early. We don't know what we're going to be worth. You don't know what we're going to be worth. So let's cut valuation out of the conversation and just do an uncapped note, because anything else is guesswork. And I don't want to start the business by doing guesswork. I think that's the consultant in me. So what that allowed us to do is actually raise money as we needed it. We didn't need to go raise all the money at once. We didn't need to synchronize among a ton of investors. In fact, we got our first $20,000. We built our first prototype that we won a startup competition with. And then we started taking in more money. And we've been taking in, you know, a steady stream of money ever since. So the $600,000 we've raised, that's over a 3-year period. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs don't know that you can do that, that you don't have to do a round. You can have a phase in your company where you are open to taking in money. And it doesn't have to be a long negotiation every time. It doesn't have to be a complicated term sheet. You just need to convince your investors that they don't know and we don't know. And a discount, which is what you get with a note, right? A discount is a good place to start. And that really helped us keep it lean, because we didn't have to go out and take $1 million up front and hire engineers up front that we didn't necessarily need, and hire salespeople that we didn't necessarily need. You know, it ended up taking us 2 years to launch what we saw as the first version of something that could be what we wanted, because it was a very technically complex project. I mean, we built very complicated things before. We built, for example, intracortical neural interfaces, literally connecting brains to computers. And we built that in, you know, under 3 months. But building train tracks took 2 years. And so I think an uncapped convertible note was the right choice for us, because it did help us be flexible. It did help us just make the right decisions on any given month and not have to look back and be like, well, we did take $1 million saying we were going to do this. You see what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It does make sense.
So yeah, I think that was the first really good decision we made, was to raise on an uncapped note and to really do our homework and read up on these terms so that we could argue for it, because it was difficult to raise on those terms. Because I think there's a lot of groupthink, both among entrepreneurs and VCs, and everyone has heuristics to help them get through the day, right? No one is an expert on everything. Mm-hmm. So we realized pretty quickly that VCs would say that uncapped notes were founder friendly, but not necessarily understanding the game theory or being able to defend why they were founder friendly. It was just something they'd heard. Like, uncapped notes are too founder friendly. And if we asked why, they didn't necessarily know. So we realized, if we can be very well prepared for this argument, we can do it. So we, you know, quite cynically and strategically started going out on things like Quora and argue with VCs that we were not raising money from about whether or not uncapped notes were good or not. And were quite controversial and loud. And that made it so that when VCs that we did want to work, or really angels that we did want to work with, did their due diligence on us, they found these articles and they read them and they were better prepared to talk to us. I think that was a clever PR move, actually. You know, like, you don't have to have the argument directly with a person. You can go have it with someone on the internet and they'll find it.
Right, awesome. Right. That's a good move.
Yeah, I'm sure listeners are going to really like the whole fundraising experience, because I know that's always a struggle for a lot of entrepreneurs. So thank you so much for sharing that. Maybe back to your product, Train Tracks. So you're targeting the enterprise market, and you know, maybe we can also talk about just kind of the sales cycle. I mean, you seem like you have experience in consulting, and so you know it's a lot of negotiations and a little bit of a longer cycle. How do you kind of deal with
enterprise? Oh, yeah, the sales cycles are...
exactly. Go ahead.
Are really long. I mean, we've had deals that took 2 years to fail. So like that is very painful. I think the strategy that we picked was that we tried to look at the analytics space that existed. So, you know, things like Mixpanel and stuff like this. And we noticed that most of these solutions are like carbon copies of each other. And we try to figure out, you know, what is it that makes them have to build this thing? Because it seems like they're forced to build the same kind of product and just compete in who has better marketing and salespeople rather than who has better technology. And we realized there were a couple of problems there that we thought we could avoid by going enterprise. And one of the problems is that when you are like properly VC backed, people expect you to have something out pretty quick and start selling it and check for traction, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at, you know, a big game company or a publisher, you know, someone like Activision or EA, they will have spent millions of dollars on their in-house system, and they will have amazing engineers working on it because the game industry attracts some of the best engineers there are. So the idea that you can, you know, in 6 months or so build something that's better than what Activision built for themselves, like that's a losing idea. You should disabuse yourself of that idea very quickly. And we noticed that the market was telling us that this was true because like late 2014, when Mixpanel, they were already quite famous at that time and they raised another round, they disclosed that their entire client base sent 1 billion data points per day, like 1 billion. And that sounds like a lot, but it's really just 1% of just the data that, for example, Activision sends. So Mixpanel's entire client base at the end of 2014 mm-hmm. was less than 1% of one big gaming client. So we realized that, yeah, this is why people keep building their own in-house systems. So if we could go after companies that are already paying millions of dollars every year to maintain these systems, maybe we can get them to pay us tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to work with our prototype. And that's a better way
to build it.
Well, it's always an ongoing project, and it's an ongoing project because of the changing data schemas and, you know, the fragility of the work you do. Like, you build a system that suits your needs today, but you already know it doesn't suit your needs for tomorrow. So we wanted to build a system that will evolve with the client. That basically the first thing we built, the thing that took us 2 years to build, was that we built a version control system for data models so that you could handle all of these changes in what's called schema. You could handle all the changes without it breaking stuff. Like at Zynga, they released a white paper once on their in-house analytics system, and they had 12 different databases in production and 6,000 different reports. And every 1 megabyte that got sent into the system ended up being 6 megabytes after all the different copies and all the so-called ETL processes that try to make all the new formats of data fit with the old formats of data and the old formats of data fit with the new. So it's a costly problem. And if you can go to them and say that, hey, we can give you the freedom, start iterating on your data formats again, and we will save you millions of dollars per year, they'll listen, right? They'll definitely mm-hmm. give you a shot. Because an in-house system is never done. And that was the big realization we had. So the problem with the long sales cycle is that these bigger companies, especially like the really big ones, like the Fortune 100s and whatnot, they have just intense due diligence processes that they have to put you through. They have stakeholders upon stakeholders, and they have meetings that they only have once a month or once per quarter, and maybe they only buy new stuff twice a year. So it was we definitely made life hard for ourselves going after the enterprise, but we felt that it was a better long-term bet, where we said that we will be moving slowly but steadily and address something that, you know, arguably is $100 billion do-it-yourself market. Mm-hmm. And if you can capture just a little bit of that and capture people's imagination that they don't have to build all of these things from scratch all the time, you know, we think that's promising. I mean, there's nothing to say that this is actually going to be wildly successful. Of course, you know, we want to believe that. It's just we went after the biggest problem we could find, which I think is, you know, in hindsight, I think that there were a lot of people that told us, you know, don't do that. Find a small problem that you can solve right now and get some money for it. But I think that that's what the entire market has been doing for so long. And that's why the industry hasn't moved on very far. You know, there's this joke. You know what SQL is?
Yeah. SQL? Yeah. The database?
Yeah. Yeah, SQL. Yeah. So there's this joke that says that a SQL query walks into a bar, walks up to two tables and asks, may I join you?
Yeah.
Right? And like, if you're a nerd like me, that's a pretty funny joke. But what's really upsetting is that that joke is probably older than I am. Like literally older than I am as a person. So not that much has happened with how we deal with data. And I think that is because sometimes market forces prevent us from doing the really big innovation. You know, it's the same reason, like, why did it take so long to get electric cars be viable? Because sometimes market forces are not good at making these long-term bets. And we started realizing that Beijing is a good place for us to make these long-term bets. And going after enterprise is a good way for us to go after these long-term bets.
Okay, let's talk about why you guys are in Beijing. I read somewhere, I think you published it recently, were saying that the real place for big data is not really the US, but China. Obviously, there is a lot of data there. But so you're basically saying that the US market is just not interesting, too small, not challenging. What's the thing with that?
It's definitely not too small, but you have to look at, you know, where are things going to be 5-10 years from now? You know, you're investing in your own future. And, you know, my cell phone provider or my telco provider in China has more active subscribers than there are people living in North America. So that's a big data set, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at, you know, arguably my favorite startup to have come out of Beijing is Tantan. And Tantan, this dating platform, you know, when they were just a tiny little seed stage company, by China terms, you know, they were already generating 50 gigabytes of server logs every day, which is a lot. And they were just barely started. And we worked with them for 6 months or so. And after those 6 months, they were already at 0.5 terabyte per day in server logs. And this is like for a company that is still very, very early stage. And we realized that, one, the data sets are huge here, definitely huge and challenging. But also more interestingly, because the Chinese internet is so new, there are fewer sunk costs into old paradigms that don't work very well. When I came to China for the second time in early 2011, we were doing some consulting for companies like Sina Weibo and Renren and stuff like that. And one of the dirty industry secrets was that the really big players at the time, like Weibo and Alibaba and some other, perhaps it was Tencent, they were sharing Hadoop talent because you couldn't find enough qualified Hadoop people in China to build a Hadoop system. And what that meant is that when Spark came along, which is, you know, a very real challenger to the Hadoop paradigm, China was all over it because there was nothing stopping them from embracing it. And very, very quickly, we saw that there was a massive amount of very talented Spark engineers in China. And we noticed that a lot of the Spark engineers in Silicon Valley were being imported from Beijing. And then we figured, well, then what we should do is we should just tell people to stay, right? If we are the ones generating the talent and we are the ones generating the big data sets, then why move to Silicon Valley at all? Maybe we can just all agree to stay and make ourselves a powerhouse.
It also enables you to go longer with the startup. I mean, obviously costs are cheaper in Beijing. Maybe not significantly anymore now, but it used to be.
Oh, no, they are for these. I mean, I think there's a difference between like engineers and programmers. And programmers are still like cheap in Beijing. But for building something like Train Tracks, you need really talented people. And they are expensive. But they are... you can give them a better quality of life in Beijing than you can in Silicon Valley. Because like the kind of engineers that we have, they would easily cost us $200,000 a year each in Silicon Valley. And that wouldn't be a super competitive salary there, right? It would be easy to imagine that Google would just come steal them from us for $300,000 and we wouldn't be able to compete. But here, you know, we can give them, you know, 25,000 renminbi a month, and that's a good lifestyle.
Right.
So, you know, it's not that we're exploiting cheap labor as much as just life in general is cheaper here. So you can give people really attractive offers.
Very cool. Okay, so let's move to our next topic, which is hashtag Bay Area movement. This is actually something new for me to learn. Care to explain?
Yeah, so
it's actually related to
hashtag Bay Area started as a joke that just really took off. So there's this thing, you know, people say that, oh, China only copies, they make bad copies. And I think that's an intensely unfair thing to say. You know, people used to say RenRen is just a copy of Facebook. I was like, come on, Facebook was just a copy as well. You know, I was on my first social network that looked very much like Facebook, like 10 years before Facebook launched. Like, let's be real, we copy too. It's just we get, you know, angry when Chinese people do it. And we were hosting the first ever Spark meetup in Beijing. We were sponsoring it. And we wanted to give a talk about the fact that, hey, we should stay, right? Mm-hmm. And as a joke, we printed a couple of t-shirts that said hashtag Bay Area, B-E-I, like in Beijing. And the joke being that let's just own that people think we make bad copies of stuff. Bay Area is just a bad copy of the Bay Area. But people really enjoyed it and started buying our t-shirts and, you know, started wearing them like fashion statements.
That's, you know, also, you know, a good way to bootstrap, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we decided we didn't want to have a t-shirt sales business. So we give out the design files to people that want them. We don't want to own the Bay Area movement because we think what Beijing needs is for Beijing to find an identity and take some pride in itself and continue to do the good work that's happening in the community that will define it as its own place. So really what we want, the goal of the Bay Area movement, is for Beijing to see itself as a viable option to other places with its own identity. What started as a joke as this is just a poor copy is now a movement about, no, no, we are the original Beijing and we get to define what that is.
Yeah, I see this running a lot. I think especially the last year or so, maybe a little more. And yeah, I'm also part of that group of people believing that Beijing should have its own identity, and this whole copying thing is not really something, you know, I guess viable to keep speak about. You know, Chinese people copy everything, and you know, copying is happening all the time. But still, I guess that there is, and that leads me to the next question. I guess there are startups that are better to do in China vs. better to grow in the US. And connecting to what we just said, I wonder what you think about this.
I think Beijing is a fantastic incubator. I think because you can come here and set up shop, and if you avoid expat life, you know, if you decide that I'm actually going to live in Beijing and not in Central Park, Beijing, you can have a very cheap life here. You know, I just had my lunch delivered before we went on this podcast, right? And that was $2 and it's good food, right? And of course you can eat, you know, 100 renminbi lunches in Beijing as well. And I think a lot of expats do that. And I think it's a mistake. If you, you know, come out into Haidian instead and you plant yourself near the universities where the students are, not only will you be surrounded by great talent, and people that are excited about working at startups, but you're also in a part of town that is geared towards the students' budget. And like we ran our founding team for the first 6 months. It was just, you know, the three of us. We lived a very comfortable life for a total of $5,000 a month. So that's three of us sharing $5,000 a month. And we were very happy, very comfortable. Like there was nothing wrong with the life we were living. We could have beer whenever we wanted to have beer, you know, there's no problem. And that is very valuable. So even if you're building something for another market, you can still come build your prototype in Beijing. You know, instead of asking for $100,000 from some incubator somewhere and they'll take 8% of your company. Just go to Beijing, right? And you can, like, if there's a couple of you, you know, if you're a founder team, like, it's actually, you can actually go out and literally teach English and make enough money to fund your other co-founders, like food and clothe them. And we went through a period like that where Ryan, one of my co-founders, just instead of, you know, wanting to go get money from investors or borrowing money from somebody, he's like, I'm just going to go out and teach English for a little bit. And that kept the lights on, you know, mm-hmm. just one person going out, getting a job. It took him one day to get that job. It's like, I'm going to teach English. Same day, he has a job. Beijing is amazing that way, right? If you can find an apartment the same day, you can find a job the same day, you can find friends the same day. It's just a very Indeed. Welcoming place.
Indeed.
So I think any startup that needs time to build a prototype, and also any startup that, you know, knows enough about what they want to do that they don't need to go through an actual incubator. Like, I've done enterprise sales for a long time, so I didn't need someone to teach me to do that. And Ryan has been working with big data for 8 years, so he didn't need anyone to do that. And Jeff, our third co-founder, he's been an engineer and an academic for many years, and he didn't need anyone to teach him how to do those things. And we knew that, hey, this is going to be like 2 years before we need to start asking for advice. Like, we need to build this prototype before we need to start asking for advice. And it's funny because, like, now 3 years down the line, now we need help, you know, because now we're at the point where, you know, a typical startup has, you know, launched something, and now it's about how do we scale this? How do we, you know, all of these things. Cool. So if you need some time to build something, if you're doing some deep tech, if you're doing something that can't be built at a hackathon, then you build it in Beijing.
Cool. Very interesting. So I know you spend time in Silicon Valley as well. So you must, I mean, already throughout this interview, you've been kind of comparing, but maybe you can give us some of your good and bad of both sides.
I mean, Silicon Valley is an amazing place in many ways. And, you know, it's hard to be there and not feel like you are in a modern day Florence, you know, of the Renaissance. There are so many talented people there. There are so many, you know, big dreams there. But I think the thing that is missing for me is I feel that the culture has gotten toxic. I don't think it was always toxic, but I think the culture has gotten toxic now. I think that there has been an unchecked and unexamined conflict of interest between the entrepreneur class and the investor class that has, you know, led to an arms race of pretty dishonest arguments. Like, we noticed when we did this PR thing on Quora, right, that there are many investors that will just straight up lie to entrepreneurs to get the terms that they want. You know, the same way that we were doing PR and we wanted people to see that, hey, uncapped notes are a pretty good idea. There were like dark forces out there that would go and just straight up lie and say that, like, I have never heard any argument, good or bad, for why uncapped notes should be used. It's like, that's bullshit. We had a long argument on Quora just a month ago. You're lying, right?
Or you just didn't do the search.
No. Like, the same person. Like, I know I've had the argument with this person, right? Mm-hmm. It's just genuinely people lie. And I think there's a lot of people that just lie to entrepreneurs, straight up lie to entrepreneurs, because it is in their financial interest. And I also think that, you know, we've ended up with this very toxic culture where we go through these workshops where we have to learn how to give a 5-minute pitch and how to release our product very quickly. And we're given all these methodologies like lean and agile, and here's a pitch deck format. And all of this is geared towards not being a successful business, but being good at raising money, right? These mm-hmm. are not things that make you a good, being able to pitch your product to a VC in 5 minutes is not the same thing as being a good storyteller. Being able to pitch a VC in 5 minutes is not the same thing as being good at selling your product. It's a speed dating paradigm that they set up to serve themselves. And I think that has gone on a little bit too far in Silicon Valley, where people don't understand that you can start a business without investors. Like, you can do that just fine. And people don't know that, you know, actually venture capital is a very poor performing asset class. People don't know that studies suggest that 9 out of 10 fund, right? 9 out of 10 funded startups fail. And out of the 1 in 10 that succeed, Some studies show that only 1/3 of founders make more money on that exit than if they had kept their normal job. People don't know these things because the VCs won't tell you. And I think it's important that the entrepreneurs start wising up and reading up and understanding that VCs, they do this every day. They negotiate these things every day, and you only do it once. So the VC is going to be better prepared. So you should spend at least 1 month doing nothing else but reading about term sheets and understanding the game theory of the negotiation you're about to go into. And I think that's a really toxic thing about Silicon Valley, that Silicon Valley is owned by the venture capital class.
Mm-hmm. And what are the good things that you still think worth for, I mean, compared to Beijing in Silicon Valley?
I think good things about Silicon Valley is it's unequivocally, it's a beacon for talent. You know, I have to admit that all of these people that trained in Beijing still move to Silicon Valley. And they move there because you can have a very amazing quality of life there. I mean, Silicon Valley is a lovely place to live. It's a lovely place to do all kinds of things. But I think some people have more of a frontier mentality. And I'm one of those people. Like, I like the frontier. I don't mind that things are difficult, you know, because I would rather be at a place that is changing quickly than a place that is comfortable. Like, I want to make a mark on the community mm-hmm. that I'm in. And it's very hard to make that kind of mark in a community that is already quite static and arguably stagnant as well. So, I mean, as self-serving as this may sound, I think a lot of the bad things about Beijing is also what makes it great. It is a frontier and it separates the wheat from the chaff. You know, people that can't cut it leave. You know, I'm never sad when someone who's been in Beijing for 1 year leaves because they just couldn't cut it. You know, have the people that can stay because they are survivors, they're thrifty, they know how to get shit done. And one of my favorite things about Beijing is that it attracts just very hardworking, eccentric, interesting people. You know, if you're looking for a co-founder, Beijing is a great place to find a co-founder because weird and talented people find themselves here. It doesn't matter if they moved here from Shenzhen or from Singapore or from Sweden or even Shijiazhuang, right?
Mm-hmm.
People move to Beijing because they want to be part of something bigger. I think people move to Shanghai because they want a comfortable expat lifestyle, you know? But people move to Beijing because they're curious about China and they're curious about the future and they want to take a part in it. And to me, that attitude is worth the pollution. Like I would rather breathe the toxic air than live in a toxic culture. But I understand that most people wouldn't make that choice.
I totally agree with you on this. I mean, I feel the same way about Beijing as well, although now just visiting and going back and forth, but my startup is still there. So we're still on air. We're towards the end of the interview and I wanted to know, and I mean, you tell our listeners, what are the best ways to get in touch with you? And we'll add that to the show notes. And also, we'll be interesting probably adding some of those Quora questions because I'm sure people would like to dig into those.
The best way, I mean, I try to answer every email I get. So the best way to reach me is through email. So just email me at nils@traintracks.io. And I'll try to get back with you within a day. And really, if you're interested in fundraising and arguments for why convertible notes are good, just go on Quora and search for me and you'll find me fighting with the VCs on there.
We'll add some links. We'll add some links on that. Nils, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you guys for having me. This has been really fun.
I learned a lot. Thank you very much. Cheers.
Thank you, guys.
Doing business in China is a complex world. You can quickly feel alone and lost in its maze. But don't worry, China Business Cast is here for you. Sign up for our newsletter and regular updates on our website at www.chinabusinesscast.com. Thanks for tuning in.